Accession number 28411, Reel 5.
Well, didn't matter much. It was pretty hot. I mean, there was no feeling. These blokes were lined up. There were officers, I remember. I suppose there were other ORs. I don't remember, but I remember one particular night. This went on 24 hours a day to get rid of them all. And this particular night, they were officers, and they had many, many girlfriends, and I suppose other friends as well, but certainly had some of them had girlfriends seeing them off, and of course there's a lot of noise and so forth, and some of us were trying to sleep in between guard duty, and we eventually told them to shut up, and they did. That was about all. We had some leave was granted. Some of the blokes went off to Damascus on leave. But after 9 weeks, the battalion was moved north. Went inland from Tripoli. There was a suggestion that the Germans were going to send paratroops into land in the north of Syria and invade the Middle East down through there. This is the reason why we were sent north, we being, I think, our brigade. I'm not too sure about that, because the rest of the 7th Division were inland, Damascus. Anyway, we went to a place called the Water Point. I can't remember the Arabic name for the village. It was about 25 miles inland from Tripoli, at the foot of the mountains. Again, we were quite comfortable there in a quartered-in village buildings. And our company was sent up into the mountains, right to the top, and it was covered in snow, of course, quite high. I can't remember the height, but it was quite high, and we lived in the snow. We were there as a sort of an outpost. We could see the border in the background and Turkey and beyond from where we were, but all we did was we were under canvas, lived in the snow. I think we were only up there for about 2 or 3 weeks. And it was too snowy and slushy to do much patrolling. But we had good meals, hot meals, and table brought up by donkey. And then down we went again to battalion headquarters, where we got some leave. Leave was granted. And around about the end of January, we heard that we were to pack up, and we all guessed that probably we were going home. We knew that the Japs had entered the war, of course.
What was that like? Well, knowing that the Japanese had entered the war, December
7th, 1941. That was
1940,
yeah. Pearl Harbor. That's right. Well, we would have heard in December, I can't remember. Doug Burgess and myself were on leave, on a week's leave in Jerusalem. And I know we knew that we were there over Christmas, New Year. And I know we knew then that the Japs and so forth. And we were a little bit uneasy. We felt that we should not be in the Middle East. We should be back in Australia. We didn't quite know then what was going to happen, whether the Japs were getting any closer to Australia. But it was only subsequently they invaded the Southwest Pacific. But we were, I think we probably knew around about the middle of January that we were packing up to go somewhere. Rommel was coming down the desert, then we didn't know whether perhaps we were going back to the desert. We didn't know.
Well, it was a pretty serious situation. You've got Rommel coming west.
Oh, yeah.
Japanese coming down Malaya.
Well, they weren't then, but they eventually did, of course.
They would be fairly shortly.
Singapore fell in the middle of February. Oh, no, things were pretty dicey with Rommel. I mean, that's where the 9th Division were. They were having a pretty rough time.
To what degree was there a concern that you might actually be on the losing side, particularly now?
No, it never occurred. We weren't fully in the picture, you know. You're only a small drop in a big ocean. And we didn't know. We knew the things weren't going too well in the desert. We knew the Japs had come into the war. We didn't know. That'd be quite general. What the situation was at home. All we knew the Japs were in the war and they'd bombed Pearl Harbor and the Yanks had joined us. No, we didn't. There's probably the higher echelon, the blacks.
What did it feel like now to know that the Americans were involved?
Well, we reckon they're all deaf. They didn't hear the bugle. They were very slow getting into it in the World War One. but I think it was quite a relief that America came in because, you know, they were very strong. What little we knew about America, they were a very strong and powerful ally to have. And sooner on our side than against, really, because they had all the manpower, they had all the armaments. Pretty powerful ally. But I don't know whether you thought much about that in those days. Because you lived in a very much of your own little world, really, being in a battalion. But when we knew or guessed we were coming out, I think we were probably told, we were very, very glad.
Let's talk about the trip home then.
I think we left Palestine on the 31st of January. Did everything in reverse to what we did when we arrived. We got into those square wheeled cattle trucks and down to Islamir on the canal where we picked up a ship called the it's the French Ile France, big ship.
Get your spinny sausages.
I suppose we did. I can't remember that, but we certainly had them going over there, but I don't remember the spinny sausages.
So you're on the Ile de France.
Ile de France was a big ship, and that took us to Bombay again. We only had about 3 days there, I think. 2 or 3 days.
What was it like on board the Ile de France?
Oh, it was very good. I was a sergeant on a rear gun. Anyway, I know we got into trouble because we were fiddling with the gun. We slept underneath the platform of the gun. I don't know how big it was, probably an 8-inch gun, something or other. And there's a ship in the Red Sea going the other way, and just, you know, for fun, really, we trained this gun on them, on the ship, because we thought of practice or something. And we got into a hell of a lot of hot water because apparently the ship noticed us, and it caused a bit of a bloody stir, and we got hauled over the coals not to touch the gun. We got to Bombay, we slept remained on the Ile de France, and the conditions were good. You know, it was a big ship, and it was those days a luxury liner went between across the Atlantic. Disembarked in Bombay and got on a much smaller ship called the City of London, and it was a reasonably sized convoy. Certainly our brigade. It was a ship to a battalion, actually. That's how small they were because of the Japs. We were on smaller ships. And we headed southeast for Fremantle, as we naturally assumed. And we had a chap named Harry Wright, who was in the ice section. He was a bit of a pretty keen on the stars and so forth above, and he announced to us not too many days out of Colombo, not Colombo, Bombay, that we were heading east. And we noticed the bloody sun was coming up over the... there. Wonder why the hell we're going east. And then a day or two later, the bloody sun was coming up on the starboard side. It's that side. And we were going north. We didn't know what the hell was going on. And probably, I don't know, if I suppose the CA knew or something. Well, obviously the captain did. Anyway, in a few more days later, the sun was coming up over the stern. We were going due west. And, of course, what had happened was we were in the middle of that argument with Churchill and Curtin about where the 7th Division was going. Curtin was bringing him home, and Churchill, without consulting, as it turned out, Australia, wanted us to go to Burma. And, of course, we're in the middle of that ruddy argument. And by the time that Curtin had won the argument...
Sorry, you were talking about that time where Curtin decides, no, I'm bringing my troops home, we need them home. And he's standing up for Churchill.
Yes, well, of course... we didn't know till afterwards that we were in fact heading for Java. And thank God the Japs got there before us, because some of them, as you may recall, landed and were POWs, but we were behind the 2nd, 3rd machine guns, it was, and we were the convoy behind them, and we were diverted from there, of course, to Burma. And then there was this argument with Kurt, and we ran out of fuel the whole... The convoy ran out of fuel, and we didn't have enough to get back to Fremantle, or go on to Fremantle, and we eventually ended up at Trigamalee, refuel, and of course came back to Fremantle. But just on Churchill, we didn't know a great deal about, if anything, about what went on there, but on reflection, I personally, and it's shared by many of my friends, colleagues, that Churchill was very arrogant to... we were heading home to our own country to defend it. The Japs were coming down through Malaya, and we were very anxious about this. And to divert us to Burma, which was to help the 14th Army, which was there to sort of indirectly save England and the Allies, made me a little bit bitter about Churchill. I know he did wonderful things during the war, and he really saved England and so forth and so on. But when you reflect on all the Australians, Anzacs, who went to the Middle East, went to England during World War II, left their home country to save another country, the other side of the other hemisphere. And indeed, World War I, where all those Australian lives were lost fighting for England, because Australia wasn't under any threat. I just feel a little bit bitter about Churchill's approach.
Well, history... relates that Churchill balls up the plans for Gallipoli. So that, I mean, was there animosity?
Look, I don't know. I can't talk about Italy, but apparently...
Gallipoli.
Lives become very cheap during the war, don't they? You know, we'll go in here and we'll have a crack at that. Lives and lives are lost. But I understand that's what happened, that Churchill messed it up.
Well, there is that.
And it makes that, you know, puts that doubt in your mind about some of his judgments. But, you know, I'm a very, very, very minor bit player in the show. I mean, he was a big wheel.
Well, so people would argue that the good general is the general that is willing to sacrifice his men.
Yes, well, I agree with that, and I've got it, of course, in war. But
you're being one of them at the time. How did you feel?
Well, we didn't know then. We were just going round the circle. They don't tell you these bods up there. We just didn't know, but we've heard all about it since, about the argument. We didn't know Curtin and Coe were arguing about it. I don't remember when I first heard about it, when we probably came back to Australia, I suppose, but thinking about it, knowing and being in the middle of it all, I was very disappointed that Churchill showed the attitude of his, and maybe the Brits generally, I don't know, but no one seemed to be worried about us. The Americans were, and I think probably because we were a very good base to have, I don't know, but we were expendable. That's my view and the view of a lot of others too. Yeah. I've gotten into trouble for expressing my view. At a Plovers meeting, I expressed, we had a talk on the Australians in war, and I got up and expressed my view about Churchill. And there was a British chap who's a very good friend of mine now, a bowling friend. I thought he was going to come up and hit me because had that to say about Churchill. And the words I used then was, he let us down. And I really thought this chap had steam coming out of his ears after the meeting. Anyway, that's all sorted out, and we're quite good friends now, but I still feel the same.
Regardless of what the situation might have been at the time, England was hard up against it. They didn't have, presumably, the resources to send more troops away. But at this point, Curtin is looking to America.
I suppose so. I mean,
the sensible view.
Well, yes. Well, yes. I think he obviously would have, because it was MacArthur back in Australia then.
He would shortly come to Australia.
They were the people we were looking for, I'm quite sure. You know, I'm only talking as a bloke on the street. And no doubt the same with Mr. Churchill in England and so forth. But the fact remains, we were coming home, and he, to me, is where I said, couldn't care less. He wanted somewhere else, and it would appear, I'm probably right, that we were expendable.
Yeah. Well, how was Curtin seen by the average?
He was the kingpin and the saviour and so forth, but I don't know how many people know he was a conscientious objector to, in World War I, John Curtin. Did you know that? Well, he was. So, it doesn't sort of condemn him entirely, but he was a World War II Australian hero, mainly because he was Prime Minister, I think. And he only lived just down here.
So given what you've said about troops going off to fight for king and country, it sounds as though you had a pretty sensible view as regard being a conscientious objector in World War
I. Oh, well, any time. Any time there, those dreadful things that some used to do. Their sons were away, and they'd send a yellow feather. You knew about that?
I'd heard the stories about.
There's more so World War I than two, I think.
Things like that. Did you know at the time? I mean, were there people being treated badly or poorly because they didn't believe in war?
Oh no, well, we were away. Mostly they went away in 1940. And we were only in Australia for a short while before we went to New Guinea. But, yes, a bloke, obviously, in his 20s in Sibley Street, walking, going to the pub or something, someone would say, well, why the hell isn't he in uniform? You know, there was that thought.
Yeah.
Mainly mothers and sons away and say, well, lost a son or lost someone during the war. Yes, there was that. It wasn't very obvious, but it was there, certainly there. And even now, if now I'm so and so, and he didn't go away, I wonder what the hell happened to him. And the usual term is he was deaf, he couldn't hear the bugle. But there were a few of those around, and that. I was going to say stigma. It's not a stigma. You don't know the real reason, but You wonder why? What stopped them?
So here you are, back on the Ile de France. You're doing a merry-go-round in the middle of the sea.
Yeah.
Presumably, you would return to Fremantle. What was it like to come back to Fremantle?
Well, you might well ask. We arrived here on St. Patrick's Day, 17th of March, and there were three battalions in our brigade, South Australia, Victoria, and ourselves, and we were all out in Gage Road, anchored there. And of course, there was Perth, or Fremantle, our home state, and we were, half a dozen miles out to sea anchored. And we just couldn't get there quickly enough, to get home and little. And who do they send in for a day's leave? The Victorians. We were cooling our heels out there. And who do they send in the next day? None of the ships came in. They were anchored out there. Yes, they did. I beg your pardon, they did. And they'd come out again. The second day, in came the South Australians, and they'd been in a riot on our place, on our ship, because sending the others, Eastern Staters, there, and there's our home state. Anyway, we got into Victoria Quay down here, Fremantle, and there was a hell of a mob there. This is the third day. And we were all on one side of the ship. The bloody ship was over like that, and it couldn't berth. And they tried to get us away from the thing so the ship could level up to berth. And, of course, no one bloody will move, you know. And anyway, eventually we did berth, and we got had to report back at midnight. Well, of course, the Kalgoorlie blokes just hopped on a train and went straight up to Kalgoorlie, and of course, no one ever saw them for about a fortnight. Anyway, the ship sailed with only, I think, roughly 60%. Everyone shot through. I wore a halo. I reported back with Burgess. We got into Perth about 11 o'clock, and on the phone, my parents were living in Albany, and people in the country could only ring up. And we put it back at midnight down Freo and sailed off, leaving half a battalion AWL.
What would happen to you if you were AWL?
Well, I can tell you very clearly. As they turned up again, the main camp in Perth was Claremont. And they reported, and they were put in quad, which is, I don't know, I wasn't there. But I suppose it was a big, wide-in area, but there were a lot of them, plus all the local militia and so forth who were in there for doing something wrong. And we went to Adelaide, and to a place called the Colonel Light's Garden, yeah. And overcame all the AWLs by troop train to Adelaide and immediately put into a huge wire enclosure, because they were the bad boys, theoretically. And mainly Kalgoorlie blokes was there as well. And then we had to guard them. There was a bit of a riot there at one stage. I don't know whether they got a bit of grog in there or not, but I don't know whether you want to hear about that. The blokes that came back to the ship in Fremantle were granted a week's leave at home to come from Adelaide back to Perth and have a week's leave. The blokes that went AWL weren't. And I think, can't remember clearly, there was literally a riot, and one of the officers, reinforcement officer, drew his revolver and fired a shot, and there was hell to pay about it. There was a bit of a storm in a teacup, but at the time it was, you don't do those things. Now, off the battalion went two back here on leave, and a few muggins like me and the AWL boys were put on a troop train from Adelaide and went up to Glen Innes, north of northern New South Wales, and established a camp. Look after the baddies. Establish a camp there for the battalion when they came back on leave. So we were up there for about 3 weeks, putting up tents and latrines and all that jazz in the middle of leave. And when the battalion got there, we all came back on leave. Those, you know, the ones that were taking the baddies up there, the baddies didn't get any leave, of course. So back we came. We came back through Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide here by troop train. Had our week's leave and put on a ship here. I can't remember. I should do.
Sure.
It was a big ship. Doesn't matter much, I'll think of it. And it was full of what we call snarlers. People in the services, Australia, New Zealand, a lot of New Zealand's on as well, whose services no longer are required. That's where they get the snarl out of it. In other words, they were useless. They were, dare I say, probably had a bit of a track record, and they were absolutely a liability. Always in trouble and never there, unreliable. Anyway, they were snarled out, discharged. And this damn ship was full of those. But fortunately, we just had a free ride to Sydney. In fact, we arrived in Sydney. We got to Sydney just outside the heads at dawn. We all got up to have a look at Sydney. We'd never seen it before, certainly by ship. And we heard a lot of explosions. We were out there till about 10 o'clock, I suppose. And it was the Japanese subs that arrived. Remember, they went to Sydney? And so, I think three of them got under the net or through the net or over the net or something. And they were put a couple of torpedoes into some ships in the harbour, Navy ships. And these blokes running around dropping, what do you call them?
Depth charges.
And we could hear all this. We didn't quite know what the hell was going on. Anyway, in we went about 10 or 11 o'clock. Had a week's leave in Sydney, which was magnificent. And then the battalion by this time had moved up to a place called Maroochydore, where the Sunshine Coast is now. We encamped there, joined the battalion again. And we trained hard there. We did a lot of route marching, a bit of local jungle there, which we trained. By that time, we knew which way we were heading up north, New Guinea way, somewhere.
Well, the Japanese obviously posing a real threat. We know here they are attacking Australia.
Yeah, well, while we were in that Maroochydore, they landed at Gona, and I remember in the local paper. It was a paper, and it had just not much. The Japs had landed at Gona. I remember someone saying, well, I'll bet you that's where we're going. Because we knew we were going. We were training, jungle training. Now, we were there for about, guessing, 6 weeks. We really trained hard there. Then we got on a Yankee Liberty ship at Brisbane and landed in Moores Bay, and I think that was about the middle of July, if I remember rightly. We went straight up from Moores Bay up to can't remember the name of these places now.
16th, August 12th.
12th, you're August.
You're in almost 60 years ago today.
Did we?
63 years ago today.
We'd be in our Stanleys, wouldn't we?
August the 12th, the 2nd 16th, I understand, get to Port Moresby.
Oh!
And halfway through, the 21st of July, 42, Japanese land in Gaida area.
Ah, and we were certainly in the Maroochydore then, the little bar.
25th of August, the Japanese troops land at Milne Bay. There are all these things going on. Had you heard much about the fall of Singapore, for instance?
Singapore, yes, we were in the middle of the ocean somewhere, and we heard that Singapore had fallen.
What did that sort of come as?
It's hard to say. You know, you can probably say, well, you know, we all worried and so forth, but we really didn't know the... You know that the powers that be would know how serious it was, but, you know, a few troops on a small ship knew it was serious and surprising, but we just wanted really to get back to Australia. I think from memory, I've just remembered this, I think when we turned north, I think we thought we were going to Singapore then. I'm not sure of that. I've just got a 60 years, a long time. Got that impression, I think, that we may be going to Singapore. But no, we really are. The Japs were coming, and, you know, I suppose, I thought that, you know, they'd eventually land in Australia.